everyone, welcome back to the Blame It on the Rain podcast. This is another special about domestic abuse that I needed to finish up. We're going to be back with our regular Blame It on the Rain podcast very soon. Thanks for being here. So I blame it on the rain. I blame it on the rain. So this episode is super late because I have been a bad girl and haven't finished it. We're going to get back, as I said in the intro, into more of the regular format of the Blame It on the Rain podcast coming up very, very soon. I've got one in the works as I speak, and we're going to have some guests coming up. But for right now, I really needed to finish this up, the subject of domestic abuse, which was originally intended to be put out during Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and I failed miserably on that. I was actually ready to put this podcast out when Brian Laundrie was found, or at least his remains, which it seems like was just a skull. Unless we hear more, and his remains were identified that he was dead. And for some reason that made me, well, for a lot of reasons that you can probably imagine, it made me very emotional. So I didn't finish this podcast. And so I'm finishing it now. And like I said, I've got another new podcast in the works, which will be more of our regular format. And we'll be getting that up soon. But let's go to where we were before. So this is part two of the special editions of the Blame It on the Rain podcast, where we're discussing domestic abuse. As you know, that is a subject that is very near and dear to me because I am a survivor. And in the last episode, we answered questions that were sent to the podcast email address, blameitontherain@icloud.com. I'm so grateful to all of you for the great questions that have been sent. And today we'll be answering some more of them. But one of the questions that we left off on last week was, had I watched the second body cam footage of an officer that was on the scene on August 12th? For the domestic abuse incident in Moab, Utah. So just to recap, the first officer on the scene was Officer Robbins, and he heard the call over his radio. The dispatch officer told him that a witness had called and said that a man was slapping a woman. And he started following the van, and then the van crashed. It was driving erratically and crashed into a curb. So he immediately got involved with them. In the meantime, Officer Pratt, another Moab police officer, had also heard the call on his radio. And he decided to go to the Moonflower Co-op to see if he could find any other witnesses. While he was there, he encountered a gentleman by the name of Chris. But then he heard what was going on with Officer Robbins and about the little bit of a crash into the curb. So he decided to just take Chris's contact information and right away go on ahead to the scene to assist Officer Robbins. Officer Robbins' body cam footage was released first. I think that was on the 16th. Of September, and it was heavily redacted. And apparently the Moab Police Department caused some heat, even internally, for how much they had redacted. So then they released Officer Pratt's body cam footage. And that is what I'm going to look at today with you. If I cry. Okay, so here we go. We're gonna watch this body cam footage, the second one, which is Officer Eric Pratt's, and we're going to get through some parts of it. So let's start where Officer Pratt goes up to Gabby in the car, and you probably have seen some of this on TV if you haven't watched the whole thing yourself. This is going to be painful for me. Let's watch it, and I'll stop and comment.
What's your name?
Gabby.
Gabby, how old are you?
I'm 20.
What happened? What's going on?
Gabby's just standing a very stressed morning.
Yeah. Is this your husband or boyfriend?
My fiance.
Fiance. Is he a pretty good guy?
Yeah.
What happened over at Moonflower?
Okay, I have a real problem here. He introduces himself, and one of the first things he says is he a pretty good guy, your fiancé? What? I mean, this is a major problem for me. Why is he introducing the narrative by asking her if her fiancé is a pretty good guy? Why is that an assumption that should be made at all? Does it matter? So, that just aggravates me.
I was just feeling stressed this morning, trying to get a lot of work done, and I was apologizing to him. I had thrown a bunch of stuff in the bag, all our bags are back then. I was just apologizing. I was like, I'm sorry that I get so stressed out because I'm OCD and I was just like organizing stuff. And sometimes I just have a mean attitude, but I'm not trying to be mean about the straightening things up and stuff. So I was just apologizing, but I guess I said it in like a mean tone. And
now that we can hear this, which we couldn't really hear in the first body cam video, this just breaks my heart. I was apologizing in a mean tone, but I didn't mean to be mean, but I guess I was. I mean, this is what I was talking about with gaslighting. This guy has gaslit this woman into believing that she's mean when she's not mean. She was stressed about straightening up, and he had, we know from the first video, come into the truck, that she had the back all beautiful because she would take pictures of it for her vlog, and he'd come in with dirty feet. And so she was stressed. She was trying to clean it up. And boy, I've been in this situation with my ex-husband where I was trying to clean up because people were coming over and he wouldn't move. And I'm like, can you get up and move? And instead of moving, he would just like wheel his chair out of the way. He would be sitting at his computer that he was always glued to and just sort of wheel it out of the way and with him bring dirt that was from his chair. And then I'd have to go clean that area again. You know, I've seen this before, but this whole mean tone, I mean, this is what happens. This is what you get told, that your tone is mean. Because you're going, come on, move, I've got to clean this. Or come on, don't go mess up the bathroom that I just cleaned. There are people coming over. And they're going to probably want to use the bathroom. You know, why did I have to walk into the bathroom? It's a mess again. And that you're told that's a mean tone. Yeah, I've been through this. This is so familiar to me. Let's look a little bit further.
He got really frustrated with me. And he locked me out of the car and told me to go take a breather. But I didn't want to take a breather. Because I wanted to get going. We're out of water.
So it kind of made you more upset.
Yeah.
This is extremely significant. She didn't want to take a breather. She wanted to get going because they're out of water. So now he was locking her out of her home, the van, in the desert on presumably extremely hot day. I haven't looked up the temperature for Moab, Utah on August 12th, 2021. I'm sure somebody will send me an email and let me know what the temperature was. But we can assume it was hot. It's the desert. And they were out of water. And he locked her out of the van to take a breather with no water. And as I covered last week, she didn't have a phone either. But here is a really, really, really important bit. Out of water. I mean, I know I've said that three or four times. Sorry, I tend to repeat myself.
It didn't help calm you. It made you more upset.
Yeah.
And, so then what happened?
So our goal was to come here and come refill our water.
Are you guys living out of the van right now on travels?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was just...
So what happened after he locked you out? I told you to take a breather.
Well, he walked away to go take his own breather, but I wanted to sit in the car because all my stuff was in the car. I had to run my bag. I was working on something at the moment in the car, and he told me to just relax for a second, and I didn't want to relax, so I got really mad. I mean, I don't mean to be mad.
Yeah, it happens. Then what happened?
Here we go again. So he wants to lock her out of her van. She's working on something in the van. All her stuff is in the van. That was her home. It wasn't just the van, actually. It was her home. And she wanted, told him to drive and go get water because she's really thirsty. I mean, he's locking out a woman without all her stuff that she was working on that was so important to her. And she's really thirsty. You know, thirst, water is something you absolutely need to survive. You cannot survive without it. You actually survive for some, I think it's 3 days without food or something like that. Maybe it's longer. But you can't survive without water. You have to be drinking. If you're not drinking, you'll die. And it's extremely uncomfortable. You've been very, very thirsty and you couldn't get something to drink. Yeah, it's awful. It's horrible. And she was really thirsty on a really hot day. I assume they have air conditioning in the van. But she said, I wanted to sit in the car. Of course she wanted to sit in the car. She's really thirsty. And the car is air conditioned. And he wanted her outside in the hot weather. This is horrible. This is, it's punishing her for getting mad at him. And anybody would be angry. They're really thirsty. She may have been hungry. She was working on something and he put her down for it. But then locking her out of her home, I mean, who wouldn't be mad at that moment? This is just, it's just awful.
Is there something on your cheek here? Looks like, did you get hit in the face? Yeah. Kind of looks like something like hit you in the face. And then over on your arm, your shoulder, right here. That's new, huh? It's kind of a new mark.
Yeah, I don't know.
Can I see the other side of your face? So, what happened here and here?
I'm not sure if this is... Yes, I was just trying to get in the back of the car and the backpack got me back.
So the backpack got you? So there's two people that came to us and told us that they saw him hit you. There's two people saying that they saw him punch you.
So the officer points out the mark on her arm and she looks at it as if she doesn't even know it's there. And she feels her face. And she's not really sure how to answer. And this is important because she's obviously in shock. And you don't feel the pain when you're in shock. You tend to be, you don't feel it until later of what you've just gone through. And a lot of people, you know, describe this, like they're in a car accident and they don't feel the pain. They're just trying to, you know, get out of the car or get the car over somewhere. Because they're not feeling the actual pain that they're going through because they're in so much shock. So it's actually really important. There's a few more things I wanted to look at in this interaction that we didn't see in the other body cam video.
We're just independent witnesses by Moonflower.
What's on the outside?
Where'd you hit him?
I slapped
him. You slapped him first? And then saw his face?
Yep.
How many times did you slap him? And then what, and his reaction was to do what?
Okay, so here she says, to be honest, I slapped him first. How many times did you slap her? A couple. He was telling her to shut up. He was locking her out of a van. She was scared. So she reacted. She reacted. She slapped him. Did she slap him real hard? It doesn't sound like it. No, she's probably not terribly strong. But looks can be deceiving. Maybe she is stronger than we realize. But at the same time, I mean, that's what the cop was thinking. But at the same time, it's like I don't think the cop is taking into consideration at all that she was locked out of her home and she was thirsty. So anyway, I just wanted to point that bit out.
Just grabbed you. Did he hit you though? I mean, it's okay if you're saying you hit him, and then I understand if he hit you, but we want to know the truth if he actually hit you. Because, you know.
I guess, yeah, but I
think
first.
Where did he hit you?
This is really important because the cop is asking her, did he hit you? We want to know the truth. And she says, I guess, but I think I hit him first. This is awful to watch, especially in retrospect, but she almost wanted to open up there and maybe admit what was going on. But then, as opposed to letting her talk, the cop just keeps on going. And He's becoming a little condescending, you know, not compassionate. And it's heartbreaking to watch here. It really is.
Don't worry, just be honest.
Like, that's my face. Like, I guess. He didn't, like, hit me in the face. Like, he didn't, like,
and that's the bit I was talking about. He grabbed my face, but he didn't, like, hit me in the face. He didn't punch me in the face. And that's where that problem comes into place, where she seems to only think that him punching her in the face would be violence, even though she's got this mark on her arm, he's grabbed her face. But probably someone somewhere along the line has shown her images of women with black eyes and cut lips and maybe said, that's violence. That's, I know what happened to me. We'll listen to a bit more.
Did he slap your face or what?
Well, like, he, like, grabbed me, like, with his nail, and I guess that's why it was, I definitely have a cut right here, like, it was,
yeah.
So she didn't realize he grabbed her with his nail, and it, look, she's coming to the realization that if she touches it, it burns. What's happening here is that she's calming down a little bit. She's still upset, but she's calming down a little bit, and she's realizing that there is this pain here from what he did, because now she's starting to, you know, the adrenaline's going down a bit, and she's really, really genuinely upset.
Did you already tell him all this?
I didn't get that far into it. She was hyperventilating.
She said it.
I didn't get that far into it. She was hyperventilating. So how that makes a victim feel, I believe, is important here, because he's putting her down. He could have just said, I didn't get that far into it. Why did he have to say she was hyperventilating, which then makes her feel like she doesn't make any sense? So I think that's important to point out here.
Like a second, only because I saw the light come on and I like kind of
like... Did you already tell him all this?
I didn't get that far into it.
She was hyperventilating.
She said that they don't drink, but at the point when you lit them up,
She started hitting you. But you tend to have a lot of anxiety and stress.
I have a lot of anxiety.
And what's his name? Is it Brian? Is he usually pretty patient with you?
Yeah. But it just makes me upset. I know that he definitely gets frustrated with me a lot because I have a lot of anxiety and he definitely has anxiety too.
Well, that could be a bad combo if you both have anxiety.
Oh, I'm just livid listening to this. So immediately this cop says, are you okay, Gabby? And then asks her if she takes medication for anxiety. Do you have a lot of anxiety? I mean, it's just, and what's his name? Brian. Is he usually very patient with you? I kind of covered this, I know, in the last podcast, but we can hear it a bit better here. I mean, why is he assuming this is anxiety related? And that she's upsetting her very patient boyfriend, fiance, whatever you want to call the man, because of her anxiety, when she has physical marks on her body of violence between them. What does this have to do with anxiety? I mean, this just makes me so angry. And then she goes on and says she does yoga. She's previously said, of course, this is Officer Pratt, so you didn't hear this part, but that she's usually a calm person. She says she does yoga. A lot of people who do yoga are calm, not all, I guess. But I mean, this is just a ridiculous line of questioning, and it's so misogynistic, it drives me nuts. So I'm leaving the body cam analysis there because I think it's been analyzed to pieces and everybody's probably had enough. I just wanted to get those few points in. And if anybody has any questions on it, please feel free to let me know and I'll answer some more. But there are some really good YouTube episodes by psychologists that are involved in domestic violence, analyzing the body cam video as well, that you might want to watch. Much better analysis maybe than mine. And let's go on here. So as mentioned, I have a bunch of new questions that I'm going to cover in this podcast. Thank you so much for all these great questions. I really hope that they will bring awareness to the types of things that can be looked on as little things and ignored in domestic abuse, and perhaps help somebody who's in the situation understand. And also, one of my aims is to help people who are looking on see what's going on and be able to stand there and be compassionate and stand by somebody who might be going through this. So I'm going to get to that now. Let's go to the mail. So one of the questions is, why do they say that they want to talk to you, but then you either don't talk, or if you do talk, they do all the talking and don't let you get a word in edgeways? Obviously, this is a larger part of the gaslighting that we talked about in the last episode, and control. Remember, abuse is all about control. But this is very common, that they will say something like, we need to have a chat about that, but I am so busy right now, or I'm so stressed right now, or I'm working on my car, or I'm working on my favorite hobby. So let's put this chat off into the future. We'll talk about it next week. We'll talk about it tomorrow. And tomorrow never comes. Next week never comes. It's just a method by which they try to make you believe that they do want to talk about it. And they do want to talk about whatever went wrong, but they don't do it. Sometimes they will actually sit down and talk. But most of us have noticed that the conversation is all one-sided. They do all the talking and they very rarely let you get a word in edgeways. I had this happen to me in my work situation with an abusive boss. Strangely enough, this isn't domestic abuse in an intimate partner relationship. This was with my boss. And I've been asking and asking for a meeting, and I finally got one, and he just did all the talking and I barely got a word in. And he was talking about old things, discussions I had with him months before, complaining about all the hours that I had to work and not really bringing up what was going on today or talking about what I wanted to hear my performance. And of course, not talking about his lack of communication, which is they'll never talk about themselves. And if they do, they twist it around to you. And again, it's all part of this control that they have. If they do have this conversation, they will control it. And I remember so many times with my ex-husband where he would lay down on the sofa and do what I call crocodile tears. He would pretend to be crying and I'd say, we have to talk about our relationship and how we're not communicating and this is going wrong and I want to work on this. And he'd say, oh, I want to work on it too. I love you so much. And before long, he was into two stories that he always used to tell, which were designed to elicit sympathy, empathy from me, because he knew I was a very sympathetic person. One of those stories was about how he was dating a girl, and he was an adult, and he was dating this girl, and she wanted to get into a more serious, committed relationship with him, and he felt he wasn't ready, and he told her. So she broke up with him, and then she started dating somebody else, and they got very close. They got engaged, they got married, she got pregnant right away. And all this happened really quickly. And at the point, I guess even before she, I think right actually after she started dating this other guy, he decided in his head that he wanted to bring the relationship closer. And he was so hurt to see her every day. And he would actually cry about this. Or fake cry, because I never saw a tear come from that man's eyes. So he would tell this story and about how he's never been really fully understood in relationships and he didn't want this to happen to us. And it was to elicit my sympathy. But after a while, I have to admit, I was numb to the story. I heard it so many times. The other story he would often tell just really kind of inappropriately inserted into this discussion that was supposed to be about us. And I could see it right now in my mind's eye, where he would lay down on the sofa, put his hands over his eyes, and he'd actually rub his fists into his eyes, trying to make them look red. But I never saw a tear, but afterwards it might look like his eyes were a little red, so I feel sorry for him. And he would tell this story about when he was a child, and he built these model airplanes that were meticulously created and glued together, and then he painted them, and then he hung them up in his bedroom. And his alcoholic, abusive father — I don't know if his father was abusive, I don't even know if he was an alcoholic, to be honest, but this is what he would say — would come home and get angry with his mother and get angry with him. And one time he came into the room and he smashed all his model airplanes. Now, that sounds like such a sad story to have happened to somebody. So, of course, in the middle of this discussion, where I wanted to talk about us and what was going wrong with us, if he brought up this story, I had been an abused child. So I would immediately just feel terrible for this little boy who had gone through this. But again, I was told that story so many times that after a certain period of time, I was numb to it and I was tired of it being inserted into our discussions. After the fifth or sixth time, it was like, all right, I've heard that story. I feel sorry for you. I'm sorry it happened. But can you please talk about us? And then he would say that I was lashing out at him. This was the problem. It was me, because I wasn't understanding his pain from his childhood. And I'm sure if you've been in this kind of a relationship, you're completely relating to what I was saying. So that was a very good question. I hope I've answered it well enough. A question that I'm commonly asked and was asked again very recently: is it true that most abusers will also abuse pets? No. No, emphatically no. In fact, some of them will use our love of pets to manipulate us. In my personal situation, my ex knew that I passionately loved cats. I had just one cat who had been with me since I was 21 and was rather elderly by the time that we got married. And he knew how much I loved that cat. And he also knew that I was really scared at the prospect of losing my cat. So I wanted to get another kitten, and he allowed it. And then I got involved in working in a cat shelter, volunteering. And he suddenly inserted himself into the process and was also volunteering at the shelter. And was suddenly terribly involved with the shelter so he could control what I did. We rescued a lot of cats, and he was actively involved in the rescue of the cats with me. He treated the cats well and seemed like, as some of my cat-loving friends would describe, a man with incredible compassion for cats. Before me, he had learned that many women like cats, and it suited his purposes to appear to be somebody who liked cats and was kind to cats. In fact, that helped him get women. Before he tried to kill me, while we were discussing me leaving him, he said he was going to get a sticker. You've probably seen those stickers on the back of cars with a man, a woman, and their two kids and a dog or a cat. He was going to get stickers that represented himself and eight cats. And he said, boy, will I be a chick magnet when I have this. So no, they don't necessarily abuse pets. There is a theory that most psychopaths abuse animals when they're children. And I guess that has proven to be pretty much a fact, but it's not always the case with abusers. So that is a myth that I think we have to throw out with the garbage, because it's not true. However, I will add that having a pet or pets is commonly a reason why people, women especially, that are involved in an abusive relationship don't want to leave that relationship because it's much more difficult to find a place to go with pets. It may be difficult to rent an apartment. It may be difficult to get somebody to take you in when you have pets. It's also incredibly difficult to get into a shelter, a women's shelter, to get away when you have pets. Now, there are some shelters that are allowing people to bring their pets with them. But in my case, where we had 12, 13 cats, how was I going to get them all out? And I never was able to, and it weighs on my conscience to this day. So it's not something I very often talk about. So sometimes I believe that abusers will make sure the pets are well tended for, because you're much less likely to leave them if you're worried about the safety of your pets. And again, if you think around how many friends you have that would take you in for a little while you got on your feet, you may have some. How many friends do you have that will take you and your pets? It makes it that much more complicated. So pets are often used as a tool of the abuser. Another question is, did you ever feel that your ex-husband, the abuser, rewrote history or denied something that you had a historical recollection of? Yes, all the time. Abusers just avoid responsibility at all costs. So they will deny something that happened, or they will rewrite it in a frame that makes themselves look good. And even if you yourself have it written down, have recorded it, have an absolute recollection of it, they will deny it. I once recorded a conversation that we had because I wanted to be sure that I wasn't absolutely insane. And I played the recording back to him. And of course, he forced me to erase it afterwards. But he denied that it happened the way I said it did and that the recording said it did. This tactic leaves you in a state where you're actually questioning yourself and your memory. Another thing that I often did was to, immediately after some outburst or some crazy thing that he did, I would run to the computer and write it down. And then I would try to have one of those things we talked about earlier, those talks with him about it when he was calmer. And he would just basically completely change it around and deny that it happened. So yes, this is something that they do all the time. It is a way of avoiding responsibility. It is crazy making for you, trying to make you feel like you're a little bit crazy. And it leaves you confused. And when you're confused, they can have more control and power of you. And remember, it's all about control. So I hope that answers. This is a really great question. Why do they always try to one-up you on anything that you have done? Whew. I think in song lyrics, so I'm just going to play you 20 seconds from a song from Annie Get Your Gun. It was a movie, a musical movie that was released in 1950. It's also a commonly performed play that I actually played the starring role in, so I remember it very well, and it just brings it to mind. I'm going to play you about 20 seconds, and I think it will resonate with you.
Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can be, I can be greater. Sooner or later, I'm greater than you.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Ha, does that sound familiar? Yes. Because anything that you can do, they're going to have to do one better than you. And this has to do with the fact that in the early stage of the relationship, they're feeding on you and trying to capture you and make you believe in them. But after a time when they have control over you, considerable control, then you're just not as exciting for them. And they are, in their minds, the greatest person in the world, which has to do with their grandiosity. And so if you do something wonderful, they've got to claim that it was their achievement, or they've got to do one better than you. Because otherwise, you might start to think you're actually an equal to them, and they cannot have that app happen at all. That would shatter them that you could actually be better than them. So they need to one-up you by doing something that you can do better than you, by being greater than you. They have to keep that false illusion that feeds their ego. They don't care about you. They don't care about your accomplishments. But anything that you've accomplished, they're going to do one better. And it has to do, again, with their incredibly narrow view on the world, that they are just great people. They're better than anyone else. They'll tell you that. They'll tell you that they are the greatest boyfriend, husband, boss, co-worker that you've ever had. They'll tell you they're looking after your best interest. But the minute that you step out and do something that shows that you're a great person, they're gonna have to, right there, like that, do something better. And that is a classic sign and a red flag that you should be looking for. Because in a healthy, think about friends that you've had, or maybe if you've had a healthy relationship, you're going to be so happy that the person did something right that you're going to encourage them and praise them for it. And vice versa, if you do something right and you've got a friend, they're going to tell you that's wonderful, and they're going to be excited. They're going to be telling their other friends. That does not happen in abuse. In an abusive relationship, whether it's at work or whether it's with an intimate partner, they're going to put you down for it in some way. And they're going to belittle you. They're going to make a joke about it in front of other people. They often do that. Oh, did you hear what they did? Now they think they're so popular. Or they're going to just do something better than you and outshine you. And or sometimes they will take credit for your accomplishment, but build on it to make it look like it was all them. And again, this is part of the grandiosity where they think they are the greatest. And now you're in the devaluing stage of this relationship where they don't want to allow you to exert any control. They already have control over you that they've gained through some nefarious means generally. And now they've got to keep you there. And that feeds their ego. Great question. What do people mean when they say they've been a victim of a smear campaign from an abuser? Wow, this is a very good question as well. So often the abuser, in their process of taking control over you, will try to find allies that will take their side in any argument, and especially if you decide to leave or are complaining about them. They're looking for somebody who will ally with them and tell you that you're wrong. That's part of the control process. So one of the things that they might do is during a night out, or if this abuse happens in a workplace, they will actually humiliate you. They will make some passive aggressive remarks. Maybe they're sarcastic, demeaning, something that is said to create allies with them and to make sure you're not seen as somebody that is better and stronger than them. You will usually shrink away from this. You might lash out towards them and be a little upset that they said these things. Either way, they have won. If you lash out, you look like the bad person. If you shrink away and say nothing, then the derogatory remarks have been affirmed. And this isolates you from anybody else. And it also creates shame. Sometimes they want to smear you to their own family or to yours. They want to claim that you're dysfunctional while they charm the family and charm the people around them. At work, they will often look for ways to tear you down or imply, even sometimes very unseemingly, to others that you're not as good as you actually are. They may just make a little comment here or there, but that little comment serves to demean you. And you may have done something that they've asked you to do, but then they demean it. And again, they're trying to create a hostile work environment for you in a subtle, subtle way to stir up trouble for you, to make you feel bad, and also, again, to prevent others from thinking too highly of you. Sometimes they will do this with neighbors when you're in an abusive relationship. They will have basically a flawless performance with neighbors who will view them as charming, helpful, wonderful, and they might even imply, and this happened to me, that you're crazy and you don't act right, and this prevents you from going outside the house or interacting with those neighbors who you might tell what is really going on in your house and gain some allies for yourself. This is incredibly prevalent if there is a court case, such as a divorce or a custody case. They completely abuse the court system. They file excessive motions with little or no grounds because they know then you have to respond, you have to pay legal fees. They want to intimidate you. They want to scare you into submission. Also, if you've been seriously abused and you're now away from them, it's not at all abnormal to feel really uncomfortable seeing them in court. And if you have to go into court, you can feel very intimidated, very scared, very emotional. They love that. They feed on that. They tend to bury you with unnecessary and irrelevant paperwork. Constantly reset their demands. And I'll just give you an example from my situation. In the process of divorce, there is something called, in the legal world, discovery. And what discovery is it consists of interrogatories and requests for production. And the interrogatories are literally a series of questions that you are asked to respond to. And then the request for production, you're asked for documents. So in a divorce, they typically surround assets such as bank accounts and 401k statements and vehicles and titles to houses and anything else, investment accounts. And in my situation, I had an order of protection from the state of Florida, which is in some other cases, some of the states, I should say, called a restraining order. I also actually at the time had a criminal restraining order against him because there were charges pending against him. So his lawyer filed discovery. Oh, discovery also consists of a deposition, which is where a lawyer gets to ask you questions and your lawyer can be present at that. The rest is written paperwork, if you will. And so in my case, his lawyer filed for discovery, the paperwork. My lawyer filed discovery requests. He hadn't complied with he hadn't answered one of those interrogatories. He hadn't produced one document. And all of a sudden, his attorney started demanding my answers, and I produced them, but I redacted anything that showed where I lived. So for example, if I bought something with a debit card at a local store that would have revealed where I lived, I redacted that. Just that the address of the store and the name of the store, if it was only a local store. I also refused to provide my home and work address, which is commonly a question that is asked in those interrogatories. I was in an address confidentiality program in the state of Maryland. These documents were filed in the state of Florida. My mistake, because I should have initiated the divorce. You always have a little bit of the upper hand if you initiate the divorce. That's a tip. So I was in the state of Maryland, was in an address confidentiality program for domestic violence victims. That address is my legal address. I can use it with the IRS. I can use it with USCIS for immigration. I can use it for any purpose at all under the sun. It's my legal address. They were demanding that I provide my actual home and work address. In my purview, if he had gotten those addresses, he would have found me. He would have been able to stalk me. He would have been able to follow me home from work and find out where I lived. And I realized that, yeah, he lives in Florida and I lived in Maryland. But it doesn't matter. You know, that's a very short 2.5 hour plane ride. It's not like we're living in the horse and carriage age. He then filed a motion to compel me to provide that information. And I do just want to add one thing. Florida has a very similar address confidentiality program. So it's not like this was foreign to Florida. So he filed a motion to compel. And then when I still refused to provide that information, he filed another motion with the court for me to be held in contempt of the court for not complying. That required an oral hearing, and my attorney argued that I was lived in fear of him because he had tried to kill me. The judge ruled against me, held me in contempt of court, and threw me out of my divorce. Now, this is a common type of tactic that they will do to smear you. To absolutely belittle you in court if it gets that far. And there are specific resources I can provide that would help you with going through the court procedure. And please feel free to email me and I can help you with those. And again, the email address is blameitontherain@icloud.com. And I think that's important to state because you need help. But I just wanted to cover that question and give sort of a specific example. Hope that helps. What is triangulation? Whew, I could do probably two podcasts on this subject because it is such a huge part of an abusive relationship and it's actually quite scary what they do. It can consist of, so triangulation is where they involve a place, an object, or a person into the relationship. That's why it's triangle. There are three points. It can be something like, such as my ex produced a list, like he never cheated, he said, which, you know, I found out was completely a lie. They always cheat. Almost always, anyway. But he produced a list of 10 actresses that he would cheat on me with. So he'd never cheat except with these 10 actresses that he'd like to fuck. Another example of triangulation is when they put more importance on their job or career or whatever it is that they're doing than you and make it sound like you're not understanding. Well, don't you understand that I have to finish this incredibly important task at work? After it's done, I'll have more time for you. Comparing you with other people. Oh boy, gosh, there's just so many examples of this. Like my ex would become friends with some neighbor because he used to do this thing where he'd have washed his Corvette at the car wash. And then he would bring it home, and in the hot sun in Florida, he would go outside and with a toothbrush detail clean the Corvette. Made absolutely no sense. But he would pull it out in the driveway, and it was to attract the attention of neighbors that would walk by, and then he'd start speaking with the neighbors. So he developed some sort of a friendship where he helped this elderly woman neighbor to move a piece of furniture, and thereafter she would call him at night. And so he would spend hours on the phone talking to her, and said she was constantly drunk. But at the same time, he would tell me that she was annoying. And I'd say, I need to talk to you, babe. Or I need to discuss this thing because I owned a business that he worked for. I need to discuss something from work. And he's like, yeah, when I get off the phone with her. And I'm like, but why do you continue to talk to her? He's like, I don't know. Kind of she reminds me of my mom a bit. And, you know, she's really understanding in ways sometimes that you're not. And I'm like, but I thought you said you didn't get a word in edgeways. So these are just a few examples, because like I said, I could go on this subject for probably 2 or 3 hours. But it involves where they bring in another person, another object, or another thing. Just another quick example was he would tell me that his ex-wife had the most gorgeous naturally curly hair, and I didn't. I had to actually put mousse in my hair and scrunch it to get the kind of curls that she had, and I still didn't accomplish it. So again, these are just a few examples. I hope it gives you an idea. I don't want to go on forever on this. Maybe I will do another podcast where I'll discuss it in more length. But that kind of is triangulation. And again, why do they do it? They do it for power. They do it to put you down. They do it to manipulate you. They do it to control you. Oh, and I thought of one other example from work where there was one person who we would constantly be told had different rules. Yeah, special rules for her. She was always put on a pedestal. None of the rest of us were as good as her. And she actually had been in my position specifically and had been promoted into another position. But now she was in a similar position to quite a few other people. But she was always more important and better than those other people. And they even went outright and said special rules for her. So those are some examples. Great question. This is an interesting question. Somebody told me that there was Machiavellianism at work in my relationship. Could you please explain that and provide some examples? So Machiavellianism is a personality trait that is centered on manipulativeness, callousness, and indifference to morality. Machiavelli was a philosopher, historian, and wrote a political treatise back in the Renaissance era. And it isn't necessarily related to him, this Machiavellianism construct in personality traits. It's part of the dark triad model, along with psychopathy and narcissism, that we often see in abusive relationships. They are cold, selfish. They are in pursuit of their motives in duplicitous ways. They are opportunists. They will attempt to achieve their goals by whatever means necessary. So they will bend and break rules all over the place. They can switch quickly between cooperating and working with you and then using others. And we already talked a little bit about triangulation. They're willing to do terrible and immoral things. They will often do something like create a punishment tactic as opposed to a reward tactic. And I'm just going to go back to my abusive workplace with a quick example on this that has horrified many people that I've told. So I was working in tax accounting, and before a deadline, everybody on the team, not me because I was in an administrative position, but the actual staff obviously had clients for whom they had to file tax returns by a certain deadline. And I was completely horrified when I first started working there and realized that there was something that was punishing the person who came in last and filed the last return for their clients. And you could be filing that return late because the client didn't cooperate and get it filed on time. But the boss, who I believe is a narcissist, had a punishment drink that you would have to drink if you were the last person to file a return. To me, this was absolutely horrific. I had always worked in environments where there were rewards, not punishments. But this is something that is a Machiavellian tactic, and maybe somebody could send me an email if they have examples from abusive relationships, perhaps where you don't accomplish something by a time that they believe you should accomplish. Or I guess I could use the example from my relationship where he would, it's basically similar, where he would tell me that if I gave him a blowjob and got him hard in 20 seconds, he would have sex with me. But if I didn't, I wouldn't get sex. And, you know, that's a difficult example for me to talk about. But they do withhold sex because really, them having sex, they're just masturbating with your body. They're not actually having sex with you. And someday I really want to tell my story, but I have an example from that of the first time that we were together, something he said to me that was incredibly hurtful to me. We were making love and I said, I love you. And he said, the problem with this is I'm having sex and you're making love. Ouch. That haunted me for a very long time, but it was an admission of the truth. It was what he did. So yes, there are a lot of Machiavellian characteristics in the abuse of what they do in the workplace. They also tend to seem hot and cold, especially in terms of how they react to certain events. They can feign empathy for you if you're going through something that upsets you, but they can also seem incredibly cold. They have complete lack of awareness of emotion, so your emotions can be disregarded. They don't understand, and then you don't understand why they don't understand, and you have problems then figuring out why you feel a certain way, which seems normal, and they don't. Like perhaps you lose a pet and they don't seem to understand your awful dismay and upset and grief that you have lost a pet. They don't recognize that feeling of empathy. They don't have guilt. So even after they've been horrible to you, they don't seem to feel guilt that they have treated you that way. But sometimes they will use flattery to manipulate you. They will also use deceit and coercion. They will cheat and use information that you have done to get credit for themselves, which we also talked about in triangulation. So those are some of the examples. It's actually, I think 75% of people in workplace bullying incidents have discussed it in terms of abusive supervision and how they act, that negative action that I described, the punishment as opposed to a reward. Sometimes they're seem almost hostile to you when you need help. And they're not responding. And again, that can often be used in an abusive relationship with the silent treatment. Often silent treatment is a characteristic of an abusive relationship where you really need to talk to them about something that has happened, and they become silent and ignore you and withdraw and get into doing something else. And the silent treatment doesn't necessarily mean that they're silent. They could be just obsessed with something. My ex-husband was obsessed with things on the internet. Or it could mean that they're doing what I described earlier in triangulation about speaking to somebody else on the phone when you have needs. I need to talk to you about this. This is like urgent. And they're spending 4 hours on the phone talking to somebody else and not meeting your needs. So these are all parts of what have been described as Machiavellianism. It's a big term, I guess, a big word for some of the things that we have been discussing here on this podcast today. I hope that helps. You have been listening to the Blame It on the Rain podcast with me, your host, Samsara. The content that you listen to is created, amateurly edited, and amateurly recorded by me. The intro and outro music are excerpts from my song, Blame It on the Rain, which was written and recorded by me in my voice. The intervals and segues throughout the show are excerpts from other of my music that I wrote and recorded, with the exception of the mailbag excerpt, which is from Journey's Wheel in the Sky. Blame it on the 100 degrees.